Like I turned on screen time on my phone like a few months back, and you get the weekly reports at the start of the week saying like you spent 6 hours on your phone, and I'm like, did I?
6 hours.
6 hours.
A full, what's that, quarter of a day?
Honestly, and I was like, and like, I was looking through it, and the main culprit, Instagram Reels.
Instagram Reels, what is it about? I'm assuming, are you a millennial or are you?
Yeah, I'm 1999, so borderline millennial, borderline Gen Z.
One of the
There's
Zillennials, as they call them. Yeah,
Zillennials.
we love an Instagram Reel.
I love an Instagram, like, and the thing is, like, I'm just like, oh, I'm bored. Let's just have a look on the Instagram Reels, and then all of a sudden, I'm like 20 minutes late for work. It's that
Yeah,
sort of thing.
6 hours fly by.
Literally. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the next stage. I'm Toby Vince, and I will be your host for this episode. Today, we are joined by Hannah Maxwell. She is the writer and performer of Nam Me and Barbara Pravi. It is brand new for the Edinburgh Fringe. It's exciting. It's wholesome. It's a semi-autobiographical piece of new writing and storytelling that will be on all throughout the Fringe. We got the chance to sit down and have a chat with Hannah. Take a listen. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the next stage. Today, I am joined by Hannah Maxwell, writer and performer of Nan, Me, and Barbara Pravi. Hi, Hannah.
Hello, Toby. How are you doing?
I'm very good. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm excited to be on here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Honestly, a real pleasure to get to speak to you and learn about this show. Let's dive straight into the questions today. So what we're doing is with all of the companies that we have on today, or today, all the companies we have on this season.
There's
It's a
literally
very
thousands queuing up behind
I
me
know
from every single
it's a very
venue.
busy day. It's a very busy day, yeah. So with all the people we have on this season, we're asking this same question just so we can get an idea of what does fringe theatre mean to you?
What does fringe theatre mean to me? I think I'm so in Ed Fringe brain at the moment that I'm like, what other kind of theatre is there? Has there ever been? Fringe theatre, I think it's just got a different kind of stakes than your common or garden year round trying to get like a show put on or commissioned or have a run, in London or somewhere. It's you can kind of do whatever you want because it's not expected to be a, massive commercial success, although you hope something might sort of jump off from it. So you just get this wonderful sort of melting pot of absolutely any kind of like form and stories and approaches. So yeah, I think Fringe Theatre is a fruitful petri dish for exciting starting points for bigger theatre shows and for like TV and stuff. So that's cool.
I absolutely a fruitful petri dish. I love that term already. I'm gonna nick that one.
It
But
sounds
look,
delicious, doesn't
it does sound delicious. I'm sure that somewhere in the world you'll be able to grab a fruitful petri dish, or it could be an indie band name,
We are
like
Fruitful Petri Dish, and this is our album.
yes. But
Dead at the
no,
Fringe.
but no, you are right. Like I think the beauty of fringe theatre is that if you can think of it, chances are there's a show about it at the Fringe.
Yes, and you get odd things like every year there'll be some sort of like weird theme or motif that just suddenly sort of happens to be in about 10% of the shows. No one sort of agreed on that. It'll be suddenly that there's, I don't know, 18 different productions with anthropomorphic rats or something and like loads of different genres, but everyone's decided to do that.
Yes, no, I completely agree with you. And it's really interesting to see how fringe theatre is adapting to different genres. So, for example, earlier on in the season, I talked to a company who's doing a piece of immersive theatre at the Fringe,
Ooh.
and yeah, it's very cool. It's the idea. It's basically about the idea is like you're inside the Trojan horse and your soldiers on the way to Troy, and it's
Ah.
very cool, and it's sort of like got a well, in their wording to me, they sort of phrased it as like a comedy, like a sort of Stephen Fry mythos version of
Yeah,
it.
that's a fantastic concept. So is there a giant Trojan horse like parked in the Pleasance courtyard
I
or
really hope there is. If
something?
not, they have missed a trick. But but to me, it's so interesting to hear about how they're considering something which, for immersive theatre, like, it's very big. And it's also, honestly, it can rack up quite a few pennies in order to do it. So it's so interesting for me to hear how companies are adapting, like, these sorts of genres that have taken a massive boom and made them into fringe theatre, you know?
Yeah, where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, I've seen some really innovative things. I've been at Fringe most of, like, the last 10 years, obviously, 1 year notwithstanding.
No. But,
we can all imagine which year that was.
Yes.
Yeah, things in shipping containers and down in basements. One of the very first Edinburghs I went to, I got the coach up from London 9 hours overnight. I would have been 19 or something. And my friend wanted to go and see this piece of performance art, more than Fringe Theatre, but programmed as part of the Fringe. And it involved us getting straight off the coach and immediately onto a bus out to... God, are you going to test my Edinburgh geography now? It all comes back to me every August and then it disappears again immediately in September. But to the sea out on the coast, it was like a half-hour bus ride. And there was... yeah, a piece of all these different performers singing on the beach at like 7 a.m. and then sort of like walking just into the first part of the waves. I don't think they kept going. But yeah, it was a beautiful start to my Fringe experience that year. But yeah, the panoply of different things that you can get that still, you know, can fall under the umbrella of the Fringe Festival and, you know, all the other... The many different Edinburgh festivals that all sort of coexist in that one glorious rainy summer month. So yeah, I'm excited to get up there and see some stuff that isn't my show. I'm trying to limit myself, I think, to maximum of two other things a day. Otherwise, it's just an unsurvivable month if you're trying to to see everything and do everything.
Yeah, you will be rushed off your feet if you don't plan it out, will you? Listen, Nan, Me and Barbara Pravi, this is the show that you're bringing up to the Fringe this year. It's brand new for the Edinburgh Fringe this year.
Yeah.
It is, well, I'll tell you what, tell us a little bit then about the piece and the story behind you wanting to create it.
Cool. So yeah, Nan, Me and Barbara Pravi is a mostly autobiographical piece of storytelling theatre that follows things that happened to me through me over the course of 1 year by the gay calendar, as I like to call it, which is Eurovision 2021 to Eurovision 2022. And then at the start of that period, I was living back in the home counties, looking after my grandmother in the wake of my grandfather passing away from pancreatic cancer. So it was sort of a bleak, quiet, sort of small, contained kind of time. So I'd been there about 6 months. So I was sort of helping organise her medication, trying to sort of teach her to be a bit more independent, making breakfast with her, watching a lot of daytime television. And so my sort of life as an artist in London amongst the sort of like queer kind of performance community seemed very, very far away. This also being off the back of a year of COVID and lockdown and everything. And during that time, I watched Eurovision 2021 with my nan, and saw the act that came in second that year, which was Barbara Pravi, who is a French chanteuse. I'm plugging her. You should check her out. And for whatever reason, she sort of burst into my tiny little grey world in Luton, like Franco, like a French rainbow. And just became the sort of what I can look back on now and be like quite a humorous focus of queer obsession, sort of celebrity crush, which turned into me, you know, listening to all of her music, despite the fact that I don't speak French, so I didn't know what she was saying. And then she released her tour dates. I think I booked tickets to no less than 5 different gigs in 4 different European countries a year in advance. And then I was also, yeah, teaching myself French several hours a day, fully with the intention of saying hello to her at the stage door and her being so overwhelmed by my fluency and, you know, charming sense of humour that, you know, that would be that fairy tale ending. And I'd actually started making this show almost half sort of still in this headspace where part of my brain was like, you know what's a really good way, a really good icebreaker with someone you fancy who you've never met, is to make an Edinburgh Fringe show with their name in the title. So I thought, that's a really good strategy. I was plotting out this whole thing, and I was getting partners on board, and I had this vision of sort of like, a set that evokes my nan's kitchen that also sort of transforms into these sort of freewheeling, increasingly intense fantasies of sort of like, you know, being fluent in French and being really suave and smoking long thin cigarettes and like dancing around the moonlit streets of Paris along the Seine and stuff. So that was the vision for the show. And then sort of as I was writing it, some other stuff happened in my life, which sort of cast all of that isolation, obsession, and a bit of a different light. And the show ends up being a lot more about the ways in which we realize we're maybe not as okay as we thought we were. And the things we can laugh about ourselves are being like, oh God, what am I like? What am I doing now? And you go, actually, maybe it's worth sort of checking in. And those sort of obsessive kind of all-inness fixation behaviours, spoiler alert, but turn into things around sort of mental health and substance abuse and stuff. So the show ends in a sort of, well, it doesn't end. It gets to some dark places beyond the romp, but then hopefully ends on a more sort of hopeful note for both me and my nan. And maybe for Barbara as well. She's doing fine, we can only assume.
And I mean, to be perfectly honest, I'm certain that she must have heard about this from France. She must be loving it, I reckon. Does she actually know?
Well, okay. So there's a lot of different factors to this. But like the thing I'm like most nervous about before Fringe isn't like low ticket sales, bad reviews, or like, you know, being too stressful. I'm like just waiting for that email. I'm waiting from her manager, you know, sis et de sister. Yes. Yeah. Because the show was going to be called, Barbara at one point. And then there was loads of different like names going up, being suggested. And then the team ended up sort of voting for Nan, me and Barbara V because it had like a fun rhythm to it. And it was off the back of like the work in progresses last December, which went really well. So I was like, yeah, that's really funny. And now I'm like, God, why did I do that? Because I've had a Google alert set up with her name since like June 2021, which is right at the peak of my obsessive tendencies. And then I've completely sort of forgotten about it. And then one came in last week and there was only one article in it. And it was Theatre Weekly talking about this show. And I went, ah! I was like, we're through the looking glass. It's like contact has been made, but I'm sure she does know about it. I did a work in progress in Lucerne and someone tweeted about the show, but like tagged her in it, which I think I'm going to specifically have to say at the end of each performance, like, don't fucking tag, just leave her alone. Yes.
But I'm not being funny though. It might just be a case of like last day of the show. And it's like, because you know, with Edinburgh Fringe, I mean, God forbid you only get one person in the audience. Like,
I've
God
been
forbid
there.
That.
I've done that, yeah.
But if it was Barbara Pravi, is that one person in the audience?
I'd like to think that we'd go and do, we'd go for a coffee or something rather than her just stare at me doing the show. No, yeah. I know what we'd do. We'd learn, we would sing some of her songs and I would do backing vocals.
Yes.
Yeah. So again, spoiler, there may well be something of a rendition of Voila in the show. But three semitones lower because...
I'm not a miracle worker. It is a tough song, in all fairness. I mean, just for listeners, for a little bit of background context, Voila is a song that Barbara, is it, well, I keep saying Pravi, but is it Pravi?
I think it's Pravi. I hope it is for the syntax of the show title.
Yeah,
or the rhythm.
We'll say Pravi. Yeah, for listeners who aren't familiar with the French chantreuse that is, of course, Barbara Pravi, Voila was the song that she very almost and arguably should have won Eurovision with.
Oh God, absolutely. What a, you know, le vote du public était une connerie. I keep forgetting when I'm doing the show. So we're sort of like putting the final sort of tech touches on the moment, and I'll be in the room with my collaborators. And like in this first bit of the show, I'm like, what if we had like some notes of like Voila coming through at that bit, like foreshadow? And one of my designers said, can we just remember that, like, not everyone's going to know what song that is? And I'd stop remembering, like, actually, no, you're right. She's really niche, particularly in this country. I was like, oh, fuck, yeah, okay.
But no, you are, like, I mean, you know, as a piece of, like, you know, semi-autobiographical solo, you know, the creative process, it becomes, like, so personal. And the perspective it offers on how you create theatre is a little bit slanted from something that, say, is more, like, devised and fictitious, you know? So, like, what would you... So, talk us a bit through, then, the early development of the show. You know, how did you go about including your personal story into the piece in, like, in a healthy way, shall we say?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Not entirely sure that I achieved that. I mean, yeah, my practice, and I can say practice now because now I've made two shows.
Yes.
If you've made one, you've just made a show, but if you've got two, you have a practice.
Yes.
so my practice
Hannah
is
Maxwell,
sort of...
theatre practitioner.
Yes, indeed. Trademark playful style, someone said recently. I was like, oh, trademark, is it? Hello.
That's going on the website.
It's going on the website. Yeah, nothing else. It's desperately unupdated. Yeah, it's my style, sort of aggressively autobiographical, idiosyncratic. So what I kind of did, and I had that in my first show as well, but I try and talk about things that are sort of so hyper-specific to my experience that people find a sort of something of a delight if they're able to find resonances for themselves within that. In a way that I think sometimes shows that try to be too universal, about, like, this is a show about, you know, anyone who's ever been in love. Yeah, this we're gonna deal with, like, all of this one issue in this piece. I think sometimes people can be, you know, audiences might feel a bit like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, fine. I mean, that's not exactly like my experience, but sure. Whereas I'm not saying that it has anything to do with anyone else's experience. I'm just I'm like, you know, when you're making porridge for your nan and you start thinking about how you chat up that singer from Eurovision. We've all been there. yeah, but you might have been somewhere vaguely similar. And yeah, you might have some sort of connections with that. But I think, yeah, the process of making this show, it started off as a very funny idea because it was true. And because I make autobiographical work, I sort of have to wait for something to happen to me. And a bit, you know, after COVID... I'm definitely like a show behind, I think, because I sort of had to have a proper job over a lot of the pandemic. So I think that the show is sort of, it's about, it's, I think it's five different shows in one of, like, too much stuff happened to me in one year. But I was like, quick, get it in, get it under, you know, 4 hours. So the show, I definitely at the start of it thought it was going to sort of just be kind of mainly a sort of comedy romp playing off little mundane experience with Nan and then sort of ridiculous sort of intensifying fantasies and stuff. And I knew I wanted it to be sort of like sort of blended media and have a lot of like video things, almost like a sort of performed YouTube essay in some ways, but you know, have something about how, you know, the fantasies that we have sort of lived out through our phones and through the internet a lot now. So I had sort of those ideas, and I wanted this sort of kitchen set that sort of transformed and things moved around and stuff, and I knew that I wanted to sing a song and do a dance, because I always want to sing a song and do a dance. And then I kind of, whilst I was starting the very early stages of making the show, developing an unhealthy relationship with cocaine, which is probably why I thought all of my ideas were probably better than they actually were. So what the show sort of ended up being, because I wasn't going to talk about it at all, but then it felt like a bit of a lie, basically, because, you know, the thing with autobiographical work, you have to sort of pick a place to stop. We're going to talk about this bit of my life, and it's going to have to be vaguely fictionalized, because you have to create some sort of narrative arc and you have to make things have a sort of shape to them. But yeah, the experiences with addiction and stuff, definitely they felt related to the other things. So it's sort of one show that gets hit by a freight train of another show, and then they find a way to rest at the end of it together. But there's definitely a sense when I'm making it that I sort of play with the idea of really wanting the show to be one thing and then sort of very reluctantly having to talk about different things. And the last third of the show feels more like the show is happening to me more than it is a story I'm guiding the audience through. So my relationship to the story I'm telling changes in sort of the last section, which has been difficult to play with. The show, this has certainly been, out of my two theatre making experiences, by far the hardest one. Just from the narrative complexity and the technical complexity and the scale of it. There's sort of, it's got three times as much funding and many, many more collaborators than my first piece of work, which is great and which is also scary. So we've been, we've had to sort of like put in a lot of, to do things quite carefully, because there's a lot of, the way like my family and my grandmother is sort of involved in the show. So that's had to be done quite carefully. But thankfully, my family have been great about it. And I was also careful to be like, although my granddad's passing is sort of a context at the start of the show, I realised very early on that I didn't want that to be like the main driving energy before, because I thought that would be too painful. And I think I was right in that call. But my nan's voice does appear in the show in dialogue. So we got to do these voiceover recordings together, which she really enjoyed. So that's felt okay. And then the my experiences within it have been really held by my collaborators, by sort of checking in and, having some therapy and stuff along the side of it as well. So I think I'm pretty much getting to a point now where I can think of it as a show and a job, but my job is to learn my fucking lines and perform it. there's been some points in the last couple of months where I was, been very close to being like, actually, is this something, is this going to be fun or is this going to be too hard to do and is it worth it? I had to have some hard chats with myself about that. But I think my conclusion has been, to paraphrase Lois Weaver, an old mentor of mine, the only way home is through the show. And I feel like there'll be, regardless of any sort of the traditional metrics of fringe success, I think there'll be some kind of peaceful space come September, having told this story and having got it out. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
And I think there's such beauty in being able to express like a true story, because it's you are right, there's a fine line between writing honestly like a piece of theater or quite honestly a therapy piece, it's good to have those moments where you're talking about yourself quite openly, because that's what audiences latch onto. It's a humanity in the writing that people draw to, rather than a sort of generalized statement about like a theme that everybody goes through, So being open and willing to discuss not just the fun, irreverent parts of like this past year, but also the very real and dark connotations it's important, isn't it?
It's a difficult line to toe, but I think I'm fairly satisfied with how we ended up in it, because I don't think I wanted to it would feel insincere with my performance style if I kept sort of throughout the, at least the early parts of the show, being like sad. So and I didn't want it to feel like a therapy show. So there is honesty and there's self-reckoning and like making kind of an account of myself with the audience, but that it's earned as much as possible. It really has to be sort of dragged out of me. And, I am a, innate, words. I was raised a performer. So my first concern, is giving an entertaining hour or 70 minutes. So there's a lot packed in there, audience participation and spoken word and comedy bits and video and dances and songs and stuff. So there's, it feels like a bit of a sort of whistle-stop tour through my brain over 1 year. but there's enough sort of, packed in there that it doesn't feel like I'm the only one getting something out of it by... getting people to pay to listen to me complain about things.
There's multiple amount of performance mediums in this, as you said. You know, it's not just like spoken word or traditional storytelling. It's you've got song, you've got dance, you've got video, you've got countdown, which is, like, in my opinion, the pinnacle of theatre. When I'm able to sit down and say, I'm gonna work out if I can get a 9-letter word. Has that ever, actually, you know, I want to know this, like, because when you sent, you know, when you sent me the press release for the show, like, so you know, I've seen like a 10-minute excerpt of the piece, and you know, as I've spoiled,
there's some countdown.
There's a bit of countdown, and you know, like, is it the same, or does, like, can you get, or is it like a different countdown each time?
Because it would be lovely. I think I'd probably have to, like, pay my technician a bit more to, like, to spend an hour before every show sitting down ripping anagrams, countdown letters. Oh, you don't need to rip countdown. You can just pick any letters.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like, maybe I'll make them do that. But no, at the moment it's just set into the video design. So by the end of Edinburgh, I will be very good at being able to get
get a 9-letter.
Yeah, but they're difficult. They've got like J's and X's in them.
Oh, that's the worst.
Also, my nan plays, so I can't go and do more voiceover recordings with her. So I'm afraid it'll only be able to be letters that the words we've got my nan say fit into. So yeah, you won't be able to play more than once. I'm afraid it's the kind of show you can only see once, because otherwise countdown would be too boring.
Of course, of course. Yep. Listen, we have Hannah Maxwell here, the writer and performer of Nan, Me and Barbara Pravi. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. So, this isn't your first venture into Edinburgh Fringe. You know, you briefly alluded in the first part that you're part of like a performative family. And this was on demonstration with your previous work. It was called I Am Dram.
Yes.
And if you're listening and this isn't your first time at the Edinburgh Fringe or any of the Fringe reallys, you know, this piece, it's done its fair few of Fringes across all, you know, I think it's not just done Edinburgh, it's done Adelaide. Has it done anywhere else?
Oh, okay. It's done, I think, over 5 years, I got up to 99 performances. I'd like to think that I miscounted, but I did double check. But yeah, 99, just shy of the big three figures. Yeah, but it did Edinburgh, did Adelaide. It's done, and it did a couple of London runs at Camden People's Theatre. A lot of regional touring, thanks to House in Farnham Maltings. Leeds, and then it did like three different rural touring networks, sort of around Dorset, Cornwall, and Norwich. And I did some sort of pub theatre touring. So there was a version of just me in a bag running sound cues off my phone in the back of pubs. And then there was like a full teched up version. I did it on a US military base in Germany. In 2020, last year before something. That was pretty bizarre. What I didn't realize is the military, US military bases in Europe, they've been there since after the Second World War, and they have, you know, all the officers and all the staff live there with like their spouses and their kids, and they try and make it as close to growing up in the US as possible. So they've got, you know, your McDonald's and your cinemas and your bowling alleys, but they've got fully like teched up massive theatres and like a thriving amateur dramatics like community. So though, yeah, I'll talk more about the show, but that was a bizarre experience. So a certain proportion of the military industrial US budget goes on productions of West Side Story in like Italy and Austria.
That's mad. That's a fact that will win you a pub quiz one day.
Yes. Honestly. Well, hopefully.
But I mean, but in relation to I Am Dram, what did you learn from it? So what was it that you've taken over these 99 performances, and how have you used that knowledge to develop Nan, Me and Barbara Pravi?
Always have a really clear, marketable title.
Yes. Honestly.
No, they're not very hashtaggable, either of them. What did I Am Dram teach you? So I did I Am Dram with the Pleasance in Edinburgh 2019. Which I really enjoyed as an experience. I was very much doing it by myself. So I had a little bit of PR, but I didn't have any marketing or a producer or really anything. So it was a bit it was a bit lonely at times. But I got some, I had some industry in. So I got lots of like tour bookings, obviously, over the next 4 years, and some nice reviews. But yeah, it's always difficult to get audiences in. And I think that made me kind of like a bit sad at the time that I wasn't getting, you know, really good numbers. But I got so much out of it beyond Edinburgh, and the show had such a life. That I think maybe this time around, I've got a bit of a better perspective on, you know, audience figures don't necessarily dictate, like, does the show go in the bin immediately after Fringe? And also the version that goes to Edinburgh, like, that show changed so much over the 5 years. Not loads and loads, but definitely it had settled. Some things changed, and it was a very comfortable thing for me to perform at the end. And, like, you hone it and hone it, so, like, you know where to pause to get the best laugh, and it flows together a lot more, and you make, like, small cuts and small changes here and there. So I think I'm hoping to be happy with the version of Nan and Babs that goes to Summerhall, but I know that it will change a bit after that. I'm probably just a bit of a calmer and more serious performer than I was when I did that. Also, I was still drinking and using drugs in 2019, so I was out. You know, Edinburgh is mad during Fringe, of course it is. You can stay out till 6 a.m. every night, should you so wish. I think I was doing that most nights. So I was smoking as well, so it was chain smoking. So I lost my voice within, I think, the first 3 shows, and then had to do a further 26 with almost no voice. So all my reviews said, yeah, well, you enjoyed the show, but the performer was obviously fighting off a cold. I had to get my, I sing a song from My Fair Lady in that show. And I had to get my technician to sing the high note for me. She was this wonderful young soprano. So I would just sort of lip sync to my technician yelling it from the tech box. but yeah, this time we've got a really good plan in place, me and my producer and sort of a well-being practitioner that I'm working with. So I'm not going to be hitting it that hard, and I'll be making sure that I'm eating well and exercising, because it is a marathon, not a sprint, Edinburgh. And you've got to look after yourself when you're doing it, especially when you're doing solo stuff, especially when it's autobiographical. And particularly with this show. So I Am Jam is like a warm cup of tea of a show. I love performing it. The audience always comes up. So it's all about my family's history of doing amateur dramatics in Welwyn Garden City, Hertfordshire, since the 1920s. And I lead them through this whole story of my family. And then it's also about queer relationships to your hometown and where you grew up. And at the end of the show, the audience comes on stage with me, and I teach them some of my mum's choreography, and we do a dance, and it's great fun. Everyone throws flowers. Lovely. This show, Nan, Me and Barbara Pravee, the audience doesn't come up on stage at the end and dance with me. It's very much me by myself on stage. And when I did the work in progresses, it was my first experience of not necessarily wanting to run out after the show and, you know, yeah, everyone go, oh my God, you're so good, you know, to receive all the accolades and meet your friends and people. I just really needed a hot second by myself to kind of process a bit. So that was an interesting thing to sort of to face up to and to acclimatize to. So we're sort of building that in a bit so that I can have a cheeky little break directly after the show. And that maybe I can tell, like, friends or family who have come to see it to meet me somewhere else afterwards. Because I am aware that this show might bring up some things for people. And that there is a thing after you've seen a show, whether, you know, if it's about, you know, certain traumatic experiences or things that you want to go up to. People really feel like they know me at the end of my work. So they really want to come up to me afterwards and tell me, you know, about their sick relative that they cared for and about their substance abuse and stuff. And I don't necessarily need to take all of that on every evening through the month of August. So we're going to make sure that we signpost to some things at the end of the show so people have stuff that they can go to other than me when I'm all sweaty and very tired.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I think in the case of, well, what you were saying about I Am Dram is that the
for lack of better wording, I think whenever you're at the Fringe, a show is never, like, done, in that it's always evolving depending on the night. So, for example, it might be a case of, say, on Tuesday night, there's something that happens in the show that you're like, oh, okay, this really worked. Let's add it into the next one. And then on Wednesday night, that becomes a regular thing. But by Friday night, you'd be like, oh, no, that's a bit shit now. It's a bit tired. Let's go back to the original format. There's, like, a constant change. And obviously, we're not talking, like, massive structural things here. We're talking, like, little minute details that, like, constantly, like, evolving. And I think that's, I suppose that, for me at least, is the key to, like, how to develop work effectively, which is to not put, like, a hard, this is it, by the end of
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. There's so many different things you can do and ways that you can scale it. Amdram was published by Oberon Bloomsbury, and I remember the version that I wrote for them, I think was before Fringe even, and this, when I was writing out the script for them, I was going like, oh, and then things, you know, fall from the sky, and there's a sidelight on huge booms, and this thing drops, and I was like, we have no budget for this, but it's in the printed script, so it will live there forever. But, like, yeah, the version you got in Edinburgh is very difficult, very different. But something I need to bear in mind is with Amdram, it felt like a little room that it was that I potted around in and brought the audience into, which I kind of like feeling that one of my shows is like a little space that's mine and I'm in control of it and I can jump out of it and play off the audience. And yeah, sometimes my work has a bit of a stand-up vibe because I will point things out if they happen in the audience, which I really enjoy. It really relaxes me. But that show was a lot simpler. This Nan, Me and Barbara Pravi has over 300 cues. So I can't go off on a little tangent and totally and bring it back because, you know, we got Nan's script has to be Nan's script, so I have to say the right thing. And the video and sound cues are all very, like, densely packed and stuff. So I need to evolve a bit as a performer and be a little bit more strict with myself whilst still trying to create that kind of camaraderie atmosphere with the audience whilst going, ah, ah. Anyway, enough improvising because we've got another 280 cues to get through.
Yeah, you are right. It's like, at the end of the day, it also is a show, and you've got to make your way through it, don't you? So this I find very interesting. I want to learn a bit more about this. So alongside the show, you are also developing care and storytelling workshops. Is that right?
Yes.
You know, just tell us a little bit then about how you came up with the idea and what these workshops could include for anybody interested.
Sure. So they're essentially storytelling workshops for people with experience of caregiving. So not necessarily those that are cared for, though they could be included. But yeah, people with experience of care provision, usually unpaid carers. And they are sort of inspired by the parts of the show that I wrote sort of about the experience of caring for my nan, which they're kind of different, but the main idea of them is really sort of zooming in on a particular aspect of the routine of care. So whether that's organizing my nan's medication, you know, making her a cup of tea, microwaving porridge, the different aspects from our sort of like daily routine. And we sort of have the kind of different doodles from like her calendar sort of projected on the back and stuff. So we sort of zoom in on those and make them sort of larger in life. And then we have fancy stuff sort of like springboards off of those. So in the care and storytelling workshops, I get participants to kind of write out in real detail some of the tasks that they do as part of their day caring for their loved one. And then use that as inspiration to sort of transform into fantasy sequences about fantasy personas. So maybe that's like a concert pianist or a F1 driver, like something they always wanted to be, or, you know, the macrocosm of like a hobby that they have. And yeah, people get a sort of real kick out of it and have a Yeah, if you give people sort of the space to talk about or their experience or write about their experience and share it, some really interesting things come out. But it's, yeah, sort of allowing carers a bit to think about their own desires and experiences and identity alongside the work that they do for caring for another without being sort of subsumed in that. So those two things can sort of coexist. But they're still sort of in development, these workshops, but I'm trying to organise them with carers, groups and service providers and organisations in places that the show tours to. So the sort of they're like kind of a bit alongside the show, but they're also their own thing. You know, the show definitely goes sort of beyond just talking about care. But yeah, I've found them sort of, I've done them mainly online at the moment, but they're sort of a nice kind of experience to do to sort of connect with people. Because that was a weirdly big part of my life, sort of, yeah, before most of the show story starts, sort of living with my nan, just me and her, and me, her and my granddad before that, and taking on a lot of those responsibilities. And it's an experience that not necessarily a lot of my peers have done at this point. So it was really nice to talk to people from different walks of life who have experienced that, and to be able to give them a little bit of a sort of creative experience based on some of the writing and improvisation exercises that I've sort of developed from working with other artists and developing my own work.
Yeah, and as a concept as well, it's good to have those. It's good to have something like this that is, well, not only linked to your show, but just available as a standalone project. Because I think, as we were talking a bit earlier in the first part, for a lot of people, theatre and storytelling is a form of escapism. It's a form of processing, and ultimately it can be a form of healing. So for people who are, in a position of care, which, as I'm sure you can testify, is a very demanding thing. You are literally dedicating your time and arguably your life in order to ensure that another person is suitably looked after for. And that's a lot of mental energy. It's a lot of physical energy as well. So having these sorts of workshops available, I think, will offer people in those positions the chance to express themselves a bit more and hopefully get, a chance to learn a bit more about themselves,
Yeah, it's just an hour to do something a little bit different, and it's fairly, it's online and flexible around all those caring responsibilities. But people who don't identify as artists or don't think that they're like creative, I quite like working with those demographics because my work is so aggressively hyper-specific, and people go like, oh, no one wants to hear what I've got to say. My life isn't interesting. I'm like, it doesn't matter. You can talk about the most boring existence and just do it in a creative way or like a committed way. And people are fascinated by it. It's that's what storytelling is. It's sharing something of your experience and allowing people to go like, oh, that's how you're experiencing the world. How interesting. And it makes us all feel a little bit less alone. But yeah, I think everyone should be talking about themselves constantly. I think that would be fantastic. I mean, in the age of TikTok, I think actually that's already happening and it's awful. But, I think some people should feel more able to talk about themselves, and maybe some others, including myself, should shut the fuck up.
When audiences leave the theatre, when they walk out of the show, Nami and Barbara Pravee, if anything, what do you want them to take away from that experience?
Well, none of my props, which are very expensive and difficult to replace and do end up sort of thrown around the audience a bit. What do I want them to take away? I think I like my audiences to leave with a kind of like, sort of feeling. Some sort of, pensiveness. I try and keep a certain kind of softness in my shows, at least a softness in at the end of them, which creates a sense of connection with me and the story, but also kind of by extension with other people in the audience. So a sense of kind of something shared would be a nice thing to leave with. Maybe probably a sense of what the hell was that? you know, surprised and enthralled, and yeah, keen to follow me on Twitter and download Barbara Previous music from iTunes.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, there's an old saying that, you know, I say an old saying, but I only use it. Like, you know, I say that, like, if somebody is still talking about your show by the time they've got back home, then you've done a good job. And then I think that, and I think in this case, especially with the, like, with how layered this show is and how much, like, how, like, humorous, heartwarming, and honestly true that it is.
Yep.
It'll, like, it's definitely one that I think a lot of people will be wanting to look out for when they visit the Fringe this year.
Oh, that's exciting. I mean, what has been nice is I've seen on, like, Facebook and Twitter just a couple of sort of the really warm, middle-aged, middle-class white people who were my key demographic for I Am Drem, who remember me from 4 years ago and are, you know, tagging each other on Facebook going, look, she's back in Fringe. There's like five of them. that's my fan base of five. But they're a core and loyal fan base.
Yes.
They're my Swifties and I love them. Margaret, Graham, we're talking to you.
Shout out to Margaret and Graham. Listen, Hannah, thank you so much for coming on to Next Stage. It's been a pleasure getting to speak to you and learn all about yourself and this incredible, incredible show. I do have to ask you, what is the next stage for you and Nan, me and Barbara Previ? What can we expect from you during and post the Edinburgh Fringe?
Ooh, some more podcast appearances. My sound designer is one of the hosts of the Eurobliss podcast. And there's a couple more Eurovision-based podcasts that have expressed an interest. And my terrible secret is that I'm not actually that big a Eurovision fan. don't tell anyone. So that'll be fun. And then coming in the autumn, we're going to have, we'll have a London run of the show. In November at Camden People's Theatre. It's also going to Oxford in September, Colchester in October, and then hopefully a lot more places at the end of this year or next year. But yeah, that's what the Fringe is for, to try and try and make a few more of those connections. But yeah, I hope the show's got a bit more of a life over 2024 at least. And yeah, I think once it's written, I might be able to even turn my head to talking about something else. So yeah, maybe a new show, maybe doing a bit of writing, or some other projects as well. But yeah, it'd be nice to get this one rolling and out on the road.
Amazing stuff. And where can we find you and the show online, Hannah?
You can find me at my website, which is hannah-maxwell.com. I'm Twitter @_HannahMaxwell. Facebook, I am Hannah Maxwell. And Instagram, Hannah Maxwell here. And the hashtag we're using for the show is #Barbara. So, you know, to really grab her attention. Leave her alone. Please leave her alone. Barbara Previ, I'm really sorry. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, no, to be honest, if she's not at least endeared by this, then, like, I'm sure that she'll love it, honestly.
I can assure, I'm completely over her now, which is a real problem, because I still have to do the show. And if I was writing it now, it would be called Nan, Me, and Leah Williamson, captain of the England women's football team. Which doesn't roll off the tongue quite as well.
No, but that's the sequel. That's the sequel. Listen, Hannah, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Toby. It's been great.
Thank you. And that was Hannah from Nan, Me and Barbara Previ. The show, it plays from the 2nd to the 27th of August. This excludes the 14th and the 21st, and it's at Summer Hall's Kane Lecture Theatre. The show begins at 5:15 in the evening, and they last for 70 minutes. As you've heard, it promises to be such an incredible show. It's going to be interactive, it's going to be fun, I personally think it's going to be one to watch this Fringe. And as you can hear, it's got so many like beautiful, funny, slightly dark, but honestly very good just layers to it of humanity that I think everybody who watches it will be able to relate to in some context. This is the Edinburgh Fringe special. We have a whole host of guests who are performing at the Fringe Festival this year. Stay tuned for more episodes. All of the information that Hannah gave, I will put it down in the episode description for you. And in the meantime, we will see you at the next stage.